KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, Alaska, and K201DA 88.1 FM King Cove.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torta. Well-cared for outdoor gear makes for successful outings and saves money. On this episode of Outdoor Explorer, I talk gear care and repair with three experts. Jay Murano teaches textile repair and reuse at the Anchorage Museum. Patrick Higgins is the director of outdoor studies at Alaska Pacific University. And Jeremy Cronin is a field instructor and partnership director for the National Outdoor Leadership School, or NOLS. They discuss how to care for and common issues with outdoor gear, including boats and paddling gear, tents, stoves, sleeping bags, and apparel. You'll learn about zipper repair, repairs in the field, and when and how to wash your expensive rain jacket. At the end of the show, we'll have information about the annual APU Clear Swap on April 5th. Stay tuned for Outdoor Sport.
You're listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA Anchorage, FM 91.1.
Our diverse city is filled with creatives doing amazing things. But even as a resident, you can only scratch the surface of what Anchorage has to offer. Tune in to Alaska Public Media for State of Art, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. Join me, Ammon Swenson, as I interview local artists, play homegrown music, and tell you about upcoming events. That's State of Art, Fridays at 8 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1. Or tell your smart speaker to play KSKA.
Welcome back to Outdoor Sport. I'm your host, Paul Tordak, and today we are answering questions about taking care of and repairing your outdoor gear. In the studio with me, I have Jamie Hirano, who teaches textile repair and reuse at the Anchorage Museum, and Patrick Higgins with APU's Outdoor Studies Program. And on Zoom, Jeremy Cronin. He's a field instructor and partnership director with the National Outdoor Leadership School, or NOLS. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Thanks for the invite, Paul.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thanks. Excited to be here.
Let's start by introducing ourselves. Patrick, why don't you start?
How's it going? I'm Patrick Higgins. I work for Alaska Pacific University as the Outdoor Studies Director, and I've also been involved with, they have an equipment rental room for outdoor programs, so we've dealt with equipment rentals, and also we do a lot of stuff with classes as well.
Yeah, and you teach an outdoor repair class, right?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. And Jamie?
Hi, I'm Jamie Hirano. I'm an artist in residence at the Anchorage Museum, where I teach a repair and reuse class on textiles and clothing. My professional background is in apparel development and production as well.
Thanks, Jamie. And Jeremy.
Hi, I've been a field instructor with NOLS since 2016. And since then, I've also worked in a few different capacities running our equipment room. And now I work as our partnerships director. And part of that is helping take learnings we've had from the field as we've repaired specific items many, many, many times, and helping implement that into new designs and ways to make those repairs easier for consumers with outdoor brands.
For those who aren't familiar with NOLS, they've been on for 60 years and have dealt with a lot of equipment over the years, right, Jeremy?
Yeah, we've repaired our fair share of zippers.
We'll talk about zippers for sure. Let's see. Why don't we start, Jeremy, with you? What's one of the most common questions you get with outdoor equipment?
I think the most common question is, what is the right equipment to use? And I think that's a question that comes even before you're thinking about repairs and choosing the right gear for whatever trip you're doing, whether it's a day trip or a longer expedition, involves understanding more about your environment, what climate you're going to be in, what the weather is, and what stresses that gear might take over the course of the time that you're outside. And I think we learn that from the internet, from mentors, from community members who may be able to help us understand the environments we're heading into. And doing that on the front end can really help us understand what repairs we might expect, as well as be prepared for them should they come up in the field.
Excellent. Patrick, what about you? What are some of the more common questions that you have to deal with?
What do you carry in your gear repair kit?
Oh, interesting.
Yep. Yeah. So I teach some classes through the American Canoe Association, and also for students who are looking to becoming instructors or guides themselves, and they want to know what I carry in those gear repair kits.
What?
It depends. It's situational. So if I'm doing an in-town float, I don't have to carry a lot, maybe some Tyvek tape to do a quick patch. But then if I'm going on a more extended trip where I'm not going to be around easily accessible equipment repair stuff, I'll bring basically a second of everything if I can. If I'm pack wrapped, I might have to cut weight. But
yeah.
Speedy stitches are great, but there's a few pieces of equipment that are very essential.
And two?
The most common question I get is, can you fix this for me? Or how do you do this, right? So my answer to friends and family is, you have to come and sit next to me or I'll teach you how to do it. But generally, it's a lot of like, can this be fixed? How do I do this? And it's getting people in the like right mindset that, yes, you can repair it. And like what skills you need to have to do that.
I want to go back to something you said, Jeremy, as a sort of triggered something. When buying things, because I'm just looking for a new sleeping bag. And I'm like, lightweight versus durability versus like, how do you answer that question? Because it seems like to me that would be the first step in like looking at something is how long is it going to last and how high maintenance is it going to be? Anybody have thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think buying gear that is of a good quality that's going to last longer, right, is not only a safety concern, but how much wear it's going to have before it has product failure, right? The higher quality, hopefully it'll last longer. So that's definitely something to think about. You can't always afford that, but there's certain pieces that you can purchase that are going to be of a higher value than others, right?
So does price relate to value,
Jay? It doesn't always, but it can.
With that, then, my next question is, how do you know something is well-built? And I'm talking about, like, stitching. Like, how do, when I look at something, how do I know that, well, that's well-stitched?
That's a great question. How do you know that something's well-stitched? Well, I mean, if you're in, for outdoor soft goods, right, if, like, you want stitches that are going to be, like, strong and durable and stretchy, so, like, does that move well with you? But for clothing, I think, even just well-stitched, it's more a matter of like how it fits on your body and if it works well for you. If you have something that's too tight or too loose, you're going to have more points of failure and issues rather than something that is like fitted well and maybe is lesser quality or whatnot. But the fit is going to be better for you, I think, than even just inspecting like if this stitch is better than that stitch.
Gotcha. Jeremy or Patrick?
For sleeping bags, I've been burned with the down sleeping bags, so I pretty much only go with the synthetic ones now. I've woken up in some puddles, and the synthetic sleeping bags work great. Even if they get a little bit wet, they're still going to provide some great warmth, even though they're a little bit bulkier. And then for rentals, too, I like using those just because students make mistakes occasionally, so the synthetic is a nice backup for you.
Oh, man, I just bought my first down sleeping bag.
Oh, sorry. They are a great down sleeping bag. Just be very careful. Those are sacred. Keep it as dry as possible. Get a really nice stuff sack that's going to keep it waterproof.
Yeah.
Also, the down,
I think we can get away with down sleeping bags for a lot larger portions of the year down here in the in the Mountain West, where it's a little bit drier as well. Yeah. One thing I'd add to what Jamie was saying about fabric and stitching is, I think we can often tell where companies have thought about reinforcing certain areas. We are definitely seeing a shift towards more lightweight, in especially at the top end of the price range from a lot of companies. And there's still going to be components like corner tiles on a tent where that's where a lot of the stress is going to hit. And lighter weight fabrics are sometimes harder to repair in the field, especially if like Patrick was saying, you only have a speedy stitcher. That's like going to put big holes in things.
Yeah.
And so having those reinforcements while still having a lightweight package is one thing I look for as I'm thinking about shelters and sleeping bags and things like that.
Jeremy, you bring up a really good point too about wear points and that preparing before you're going out onto a trip or even assessing your gear after you get back is like looking for points of wear and where things have started to deteriorate to be able to like patch and fix that it preventatively before it becomes a hole. That's going to be like the easiest point for you to start to do things. So like if the heel on your sock is getting worn but doesn't have a hole, that's a perfect time to start darning that. Or if there's like stitches that are coming loose on the zipper of your tent. So going through like all of your gear and before it's like a glaring obvious issue, like noting those things and fixing them, they're going to be way easier and it's going to make your equipment last much longer.
Patrick, what do you do before you go out in the field? Like what's your sort of checklist of like, what are you going to check? What are you going to do to make sure everything's up to snuff?
really depends on what kind of trip I'm going on. So if I'm going out, say, for a pack raft, I'll blow that pack raft up and I'll check it for leaks before I go out there. And then dry suits, especially after I haven't been paddling all winter, I'll try on my dry suit because sometimes it doesn't fit that great anymore because I've gained some weight throughout the winter. And then that's when it gets those points where it doesn't fit quite properly. So I might need to go one size up on that dry suit for a little bit. But yeah, I go through and I check all my stuff, especially if I'm using electronics like in reaches. I check that, sync it up with my phone, check my VHF radio if I'm going sea kayaking to make sure that works. But just trying all that stuff on and then setting up the tent if I need to set it up, starting the stove if I need to start the stove, and just doing that checklist.
Jeremy, any suggestions from you about sort of pre-trip prep?
No, I 100% echo what Patrick just offered. I think going through and developing your own checklist of like, okay, these are the items that I'm going to be using on this trip, and here is the 1 to 5 point checklist that each one of those has to make sure that I have what I need and that what I'm bringing, I know is actually going to be fully functional. And like one real quick one is like, yeah, it's sometimes hard to know how well your rain jacket is performing, and you can always just hop in the shower with it on and see how it's doing. And so that's like a quick one, which layers are sometimes harder for us to check than something like a stove.
Yeah. Patrick, you brought up a repair kit. So, Jeremy, what do you take in the repair kit?
The Speedy Stitcher is like so essential. I think at Knowles, one of the things that we focus on are really durable and versatile items, especially since we have a pretty large fleet of rental equipment that has to serve a huge audience in a lot of different environments. And so we're using maybe thicker and more durable fabrics than some of like the most lightweight options out there. And the Speedy Stitcher allows you to put the sole of a shoe back onto a hiking boot. Mm-hmm. It allows you to fix a back, like put really heavy duty stitching back into things. But sometimes you just need a needle and thread or some gear tape. And I think a gear repair kit that includes those items is going to be really multifaceted, especially when you think about overlap that might exist between your first aid kit and your gear repair kit as well.
Those are really good points. I just want to add to the needle and thread that needles are extremely light, but take a couple different weights of them. They can be stronger or lighter. And that there's a couple like stitches that are really good if you're in the field and you have like a long rip on your like hiking pants or on your sleeping bag that are like can just quickly make it so you're not losing all of your down or your insulation. So like a parachute stitch is really good for the middle of a cloth. So like it's used in like airmen that have to repair their parachutes. That's a quick one to learn. A ladder stitch is really good if you have like a seam that has ripped. A whip stitch you can attach a patch with, and a running stitch is just a great like darning or attaching anything. All of these, there's like a bunch of YouTube videos, but if you have those like 4 stitches, some needle and thread, those are the skills I think that you need with your kit.
Repeat them one more time.
Yeah, a parachute stitch, a ladder stitch, whip stitch, and a running stitch. Those are
nice.
4 very like basic things that you can learn with just a needle and thread that are extremely lightweight that'll keep your gear usable until you can get back and like do a full repair on it.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer in Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Torda. We are talking about gear care and repair today with a little panel of experts here. So let's talk about stoves a little bit. They're pretty important. What would you bring in a stove repair kit? Either Patrick or Jeremy?
Well, I can jump in here. So we at Knowles, we've been using the Whisperlite model from MSR for decades, and it has remained largely unchanged, which is we're incredibly thankful for, because it is one of the most like field repairable and strippable and cleanable stoves out there that takes liquid gas. And so basically what we have in our repair kit for that stove are the common failure points, whether it's we know we're going to see carbon buildup from lighting the stove in this area. Here is like a replacement jet for that stove, or we're just going to bring a whole new pump just so we have a backup, because pump failures are pretty common, and figuring out and diagnosing the challenge with a pump can be harder than with a stove. And so as you think about the stove that you have and there is a wide variety of things that can go wrong, from alcohol stoves all the way up to pressurized canister stoves. And some of those are more repairable than others. And so thinking about what stove you're bringing and whether you just need to make sure you don't crush your alcohol stove versus something like a liquid gas stove where you actually can strip it down, clean it, and put it all back together to make sure it's working again.
Yeah, and I think the type of stove probably depends a little bit on the trip. Like on longer trips, I tend to use the liquid gas stoves, and shorter trips, the butane stove or something like that. Any advice on stoves, Patrick?
Yeah, we use the Whisper Lights a lot, but then we also do rafting trips as well. And this last rafting trip, we almost had chaos because we had one part that was leaking and we needed a bike tool. Luckily, one of the students had just randomly forgot a bike tool in their repair kit themselves.
A bike tool.
Yep. It was a weird, it wasn't a Phillips or a flathead. It was a specific tool or a little hex piece. And luckily, the student had brought in the bike tool. But with a lot of our rafting repair kits, because they're kind of bigger stoves, we'll bring a spare piece, very similar to what Jeremy was talking about. But bringing a replacement part for every piece of that stove is really nice to have.
Yeah, so having stuff, like knowing your gear and what you need to fix it is probably like really, like what tool you need is probably really important. Let's go on to a little bit about some of the common issues we might have. And since we're on stoves, look for Jeremy here a little bit. So a common thing, like I have a stove and a Whisper Light, let's say, or really any stove, and it's just not burning as it should. What do I do?
The first question I ask, regardless of whatever stove type is do I still have enough fuel? And whether it's an alcohol stove, checking how much, like whether the you've burned through your alcohol or your canister is empty, or with something like the Whisper Light, where you are actually creating the pressure to transition that gas or that liquid into a gas, it's like, okay, do I have enough fuel and have I pressurized my stove? But once you get further down the line, depending on your stove use, whether you're seeing more blue flame or orange flame as you're using it, you might be seeing more carbon grit getting into the different mechanisms on that stove. And they're pretty simple, but they often function with a pretty small hole for the gas to move through. And so carbon buildup is one of the things I think about first as I'm trying to get my stove to move from like sputtering or an inefficient flame into something that is going to cook my meal really, really fast. So figuring out what that small hole is and whether you can clean it and clear it from any grit, whether it's sand, carbon, mud, you name it, is one of the first things I think about after I've checked whether I have enough fuel left in my fuel bottle.
Yeah. How about any experience with butane stoves? And I don't know, Patrick or Jeremy, yeah.
This came back to an issue of I should have checked before going out there. I didn't check to see the cartridge. So the cartridge actually rusted, so then I had some issues. But luckily somebody else had another fuel canister that I could borrow, so I was able to eat warm food instead of just eating dehydrated stuff the rest of the time. So, yep. Just checking before I go.
Yeah, I think I had just finished a trip and we brought just a backup. Like we had the Whisper Light, and then I brought a little jet boil. We had a jet boil, and we also talked about being a pocket rocket, but something super lightweight that just is a backup stove. Because in this case, it was winter camping, and the consequences of not having a stove were done. Like if the stove weren't complete, we're having a long, long, long day of skiing out, and if the weather got bad, it was very serious. So I think with those, especially with those canister stoves, having a backup is probably fairly important.
Helps to bring extra lighters, too.
Lighters, yeah.
Storing your lighter in a safe place. I can't tell you how many times where the little gas piece was hit, and the brand-new lighter no longer has fuel in it. So bring an extra lighter as well.
Yeah, extra lighter. Keep it dry, keep it warm. Yeah for sure. Let's talk about a little bit about software. I'm looking at Jamie here a little bit, and all of you. But what about care of software? Like, how often should I wash it? What are you suggesting about caring for my very expensive sometimes software?
all apparel that you buy has a care label. They're like legally required to insert a care label into all of your clothing, and the manufacturer has suggested washing and care instructions. So generally, that's going to be the first place for you to look. But a good rule of thumb is that a lot of things don't like heat. So if you can wash things and dry them on low heat or air dry them, you're going to extend the life of any textile and like the components to that much longer. Like elastic or anything that has stretch in it will eventually degrade, and heat will just speed that up. So that's a really simple thing that people can do. It also save you a little bit on your electricity bill. But if you can let things dry by air or lower temperature, that's the first thing.
Oh, with the dry suit. So kind of have a story. When I first bought a dry suit, I was really scared to wash it because it was expensive and I paid for it with student loans, which I shouldn't have. But I was scared to wash it because I didn't want to deplete the waterproof ability of the material. And I went kayaking and these people were like, yeah, you're pretty nice. Like, you can come kayaking with us, but you need to wash your gear. You smell horrible. And when I started working at a kayak shop, we had somebody come in from one of the companies and he was like, yeah, you need to wash it regularly. Humans are greasy, and the materials are generally a breathable membrane. And when your grease from your skin gets into that breathable membrane, it reduces that breathability of it. So washing it consistently, and especially if I'm going out into the ocean where there's a lot of salt, it's really good to wash your stuff off because that salt is really bad for it. Or if there's a lot of sediment from like a silty river or something, try to wash it with fresh water as soon as you get back.
That's a great point. Like, washing any gear regularly and not letting the dirt build up, it'll degrade anything, not just a dry suit, but that's just good preventative care as well.
And how about tips about washing like breathable material like Cortex?
I like to hand wash like my really expensive stuff, so I'll hand wash it. I would use a front loading washer if you are going to wash it in a machine. The agitator has ripped apart multiple nice pieces of equipment that we've had for our rentals. Mm-hmm. So using a front loader, gentle cycle, but if it is a really expensive piece, I do like to do that hand washing and then waterproof it afterwards as well.
A mesh laundry bag also really helps keep things protected if you don't have a front-loading washing machine.
Oh, so you put it in a mesh.
Put it in a mesh bag, and then it's just like less area for it to get snagged or ripped or whatnot. That'll be much easier.
Yeah. Jeremy, any suggestions about washing? And
the one thing that I would add, I fully agree with that you need to clean your gear. And I think one of the pieces that I think about is which of my gear actually needs to be stretchy, and which of it is okay if it doesn't have stretch. I think any item that stretches is going to be just those two fabrics are going to perform very differently in different environments and have different levels of repair that you can do effectively in the field. And so just being mindful of that as you head into decision making is really helpful and can save you some pain on the back end.
Washing your gear is also a really good time to check it and inspect it for like things that do need to get repaired or replaced before you put it back into your storage.
I'm terrible at that. I put stuff away and then I'm like, I pull it out right before the trip. I'm like, oh man, I need to fix this. Yeah.
That's actually a really good, like in your pre-trip planning meetings to like repair things and do them with the people that are on your group. So like each year I host a free class about repairing gear through the series that I teach at the museum, and we had a couple guys, and you know, I overheard them while they're doing their learning their parachute stitch, repairing their, you know, ski pants, and they're like, this is really fun, like we should do this together and like repair our gear. So maybe you need to add that to your like pre-trip planning meetings, is to all go through your gear together and share your skills that you have.
One other thought I had on the, Jamie brought up the mesh bag. I actually think it's really helpful too as a way to separate out items that you know need repair.
Yes.
Like it's really easy to toss all your stuff in the laundry after a day in the mountains or on the water and not remember as you're taking it back out what items you might need a little extra attention. And so it's a good reminder of like, oh, right, these items are in this bag because I need to like zoom in on them afterwards and make a note for myself to repair these at some future point.
That's a really good point. I actually use that for things that I don't want to go in the dryer as well. I'm like, oh, all the stuff that I don't want to dry goes in this mesh bag. And then I pull it out and I can lay that all flat to dry. So it's a really good just visual cue for things that need more attention.
I'm going to start doing that.
That's a really inexpensive thing to add to your care.
Let's talk about waterproofing, particularly tents, like that kind of material. How do we maintain tents are expensive. Seems like the first thing that always goes is the fly. We'll talk about zippers. Probably the whole second half of the show, we'll talk about zippers. But any advice on taking care of tents? Patrick?
Going to the seams. Generally, I find that the seams will start to leak a little bit, so it's good to go. And I think it's a seam seal. Mm-hmm. Painting those seams before a trip, before you get ready to take that tent out as well. And then also taking really good care of the tent. And after you get back from a trip, making sure that you're hanging it up to dry so it doesn't get that weird mildewy smell. Mm-hmm. Just taking care of your gear so it takes care of you.
So when you talk about seam sealing, a lot of people tell me, well, the seams are taped. You don't need to do that. But the tape doesn't work, or elaborate a little bit on the seam sealing.
Everything wears out, so eventually dry suits don't stay dry forever. They start to leak as well. Same with tents. I'm sure everybody's had woken up with some drops of water landing on their face. Yeah. But just going through those seams and repainting that where that tape is, because that tape will start to peel away eventually.
So you're doing the outside or the inside of the fly?
Usually on the inside on the fly where the tape is, yeah.
Okay. Jeremy, thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think the seam, and like some tents come with taped seams, some don't. And so like knowing even before you take out your brand new tent, what work you might need to do on it to get it field ready is important. But I think seam seal also has a lot of utility for like those micro tears that are going to happen as you pack and unpack your tent over the course of any trip. And so I think preventatively, we can store our tents in a stuff sack in our packs, in our boats, which sometimes makes it a slightly harder item to pack. So a more oversized stuff sack will allow you to slot that tent down into wherever you might need to pack it, but it will still protect it. And then as you're in your tent and you notice tiny pinpricks of light sneaking through, just making sure that you flag those, you can just and putting a dab of seam seal on them is actually going to help seal that micro tear up and hopefully prevent it from becoming something bigger where you might need to have a more extensive solution.
That's a really good point. Just like preventative, starting all of the small things will extend the life of your gear. If you are like, you buy something that's really expensive and you're aware of caring for it well, and like if there's a tiny micro issue that you're fixing it. But seam seal and the things that are making it waterproof are essentially like glue, so also not storing them in really hot places is a really good way to keep that glue functioning in the way that you want it to. So the way that you store it in addition to the way that you pack and use it.
Nice, cool, dry places.
Yes.
I want to go back to tents for a second, Jeremy, and all three of you. But what about like in the field care of tents? And I'm thinking like they like to sell foot pads. Or do you use those? Do you have a ground cloth under the tent or not?
I used to carry a ground cloth, but I've been cutting it out depending on what kind of trip I'm doing. Sometimes a tarp can work really well. If I'm going sea kayaking, I'll bring a tarp so that when I get to camp, I can put all my stuff on the tarp, carry it up to where I'm going. And it can help increase the life of it, but it just depends on the situation on where I'm going.
Jeremy, thoughts about that?
Yeah, similarly. I think if you're expecting to camp on a relatively firm and dry ground, it might be less relevant, and you can try to select your campsite in ways that will support you from not ending up in a puddle. But if you're camping in a boggier area where you might have more seep through from the ground underneath, that make sense to add that waterproof layer, or at least semi-waterproof layer, between you and whatever vegetation or moisture might be leaving the ground beneath you.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. We're going to take a short break and be right back with more on clearing and repairing your gear.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Listening to Alaska Public Media on KSKA, Anchorage, FM 91.1, connecting Alaskans, life informed.
Did you ever ever see a social media post about someone else's good news and think, why are they rubbing it in?
We're trained to see content and be like, oh, well, that has to do with me, right? Or if it doesn't have to do with me, it should have to do with me. But that's ridiculous. But of course, it's how we've been trained to interact on these platforms.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason.
This Friday at 8:30 p.m. on Alaska Public Media, FM 91.1.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordat. I have Jamie Hirano, Patrick Higgins, and Jeremy Cronin with me talking about gear repair and care. Let's talk about field repair a little bit. And you're out in the field and something's breaking down. We talked about stoves a bit, but let's talk about, let's just go to like I just tore a hole in my jacket. Jamie, what do I do?
Okay, so I mentioned earlier that there's a couple stitches that'll be helpful for you. So if you keep a needle and thread in your gear kit and the stitches are a parachute stitch, a ladder stitch, a whip stitch, and a running stitch, those all have YouTube videos for them, and they are will keep like your pants functional or the down from your sleeping bag in there. But if you can't stop and do a stitch or you're not at camp yet and aren't ready, like something like duct tape, gear tape, and no-sew patch will be really helpful. But when you're patching, another thing to think about is that like right angle corners like pull away and wear faster. So if you have the ability to like rip and or cut it into something that's more oval or circular, that patch is going to stay there and last much longer and not wear away. Just like something really simple that you can do if you're going to use those.
Yeah. And is it worth then putting something up? Let's say you sew something up.
Yeah.
And is it worth, then what? Do I put a patch over? Do I put duct tape? Do I put seam seal?
So like let's say you have a rip in your rain jacket, right? That's something that you want to stay functional and waterproof. So like if you are at camp, I would suggest like doing a parachute stitch, great for in the middle of cloth. So stitch it up and then you're going to want some sort of waterproof ability. So if you can patch it like on the inside and the outside, super helpful. That's going to give you like a lot of coverage while you're out walking around, hiking, whatever your trip is.
Any other suggestions about infield repair of tears and rips?
I really like Tyvek tape. Tyvek tape works amazingly, but the manufacturers do not like Tyvek tape because it's really hard for them to get it off. So if you do send it in to the manufacturers, they're kind of upset with you about it. But if you have something that's wet, it's really nice to dry it off. Bringing some alcohol wipes will really help to clean that area off. Because if you go to put an adhesive on there, that dirt can create a kind of barrier, makes it a little bit harder for it to stick. So having a way that to dry it off and then kind of warm it up. So if it is cold outside, maybe it'll that adhesive that you're putting on there has a little bit of a chance to dry and adhere to that area.
Jeremy?
I think the only thing I'd add is think about how big you want your patch to be in relation to the size of the rip. I think we have the tendency to like keep it pretty close to the rip, but it actually will hold better if we create a little bit of buffer space around whatever that rip is. And so thinking about at least like a half inch on either side of the rip as you're placing it out, and sometimes even more if it's an area that might have more stress on it, if it's on a tent or something like that.
That's a really good point. And a great way to be able to see where there's a lot of wear is if you hold it up to the light, like where the fabric is getting thin, you kind of want to cover that area. And then also if your like rip or hole is close to a seam, like let's say you've ripped like right along the seam of your pants, the seam, because there's multiple layers of fabric there, is going to be more stable, so you can anchor your patch into that area. But that's a great thing to think about, is going larger than what your repair is. And when you like patch something or add material to it, you're adding something that's potentially heavier, and so you want to think about that your patch is going to be another point of wear that's added onto it. So making it larger and or thinking about the material that you're using when you patch it. You want to have something that's similar in weight to the material that you're fixing.
Do you recommend patching both the outside and the tent, let's say, outside and inside?
I think it depends on like where and what part it is. So like if it's something that's waterproof, I think I would suggest inside and outside. But if it's just like your actual tent, I think one layer of a patch will be fine. You can also like patch something where you've like adhered a patch, and then on the other side on the tent you could like sew down the area that has been ripped so that won't continue to fray and pull.
Jeremy, what about, I just was on this trip and we had a shelter that was, it was basically made out of rice paper as far as I could tell. I mean, it was super thin. It was an awesome little shelter because it acted like a greenhouse when the sun came out and we were winter camping. And it was super light, but how about repairing that stuff? It seemed to be hard to stitch it, for instance.
Yeah, and I think this is where a few different things we've talked about earlier in this program come to bear. Like, I think what Jamie was just talking about trying to use a similar weight fabric is going to help with that repair. And also whether or not you having a variety of needles and thread sizes so that you can, again, try to align your repair with whatever material you're using. But some of these fabrics are actually quite challenging. Like, they're not designed to be field sewn. And so thinking about, okay, if it's my shelter, what kind of adhesive patches might I need for that versus a different style of patch for something that is maybe my clothing? And yeah, when you have something that is that thin and fragile and likely expensive, I think this is again where preventative care is what's gonna save you from major field incidents where you have to sleep out or have a giant flow of water flowing into your tent. And so thinking about ways to get creative with the shelter if some part of it fails, like could you turn it upside down so that the body that you were sleeping on, which is probably still waterproof, becomes your roof if you don't end up using it more like a tarp. So like, how can you get creative with what you have if you are unable to fully repair a blown seam or something like that?
Oh, great point.
Yeah.
Can I follow up on that? So something about getting creative, this is more for your like at-home care, but you know, if you have gear that is like extremely worn out, let's say you have like gloves and you're like, these are just like absolutely done before, like, you know, you've gone through being able to repair it or not, but before you would throw it away, that worn out glove is actually a huge resource for you because maybe there's like corded elastic that you can harvest from it that you can use in a repair. Maybe there's snaps or there's other material that you can use. A lot of technical trims and materials are extremely hard to source if you're not in the industry. Like, it's not something you can find at a local fabric store or even at REI some of the time. So harvesting the gear that you have that can no longer be repaired and starting to create a kit of like little bits of webbing or all of the buckles that sometimes are proprietary to companies so that you have this stash of resources that you can use when you are going home and doing your repairs. Sourcing your materials, at least from a soft goods perspective, I'm sure you could also do that for stoves and other pieces of equipment.
Oh, I definitely do that with kayaks. I'll save, if I break a boat, I'll save a lot of the outfitting for the kayak.
Yeah.
And it's really good because if you miss a bolt or something, it's pretty expensive to go buy some of that stuff. So it's nice to have that available for you. So it's kind of like you got a junkyard of gear that you can grab from or borrow from.
Right. I have a box of stuff that goes back a long time. I had this idea about tents. A question for someone about repairing mosquito netting. In Alaska, and I know Wyoming has mosquitoes, and no CM. So any advice on repairing mosquito netting?
Yeah.
I can't really stitch it very well, I don't think.
I mean, I think you can stitch it. I think the issue is that you like have a hole and then like if you're in the field, like where do you get that material to repiece the hole? So like a lot of rain jackets and like lightweight pants will have mesh pockets. So you could cut out the material of your pockets and like stitch that to a mosquito net. And like you'd have to have some fine stitching to do that. But I think it's easily repairable to not have the mosquitoes get in. But that's another like harvesting material out and about.
Yeah, I've definitely chopped off and moved the cinch cord on it. If I had a trip where I was carrying a mosquito net for my head, I could just shorten it, make it a little bit tighter and higher on the neck and use that material to repair a failed section of mosquito netting as well.
Yeah, or the pockets that are in your tent, you can use those as extra material. You don't always need that, but there's definitely areas that you can find the materials you need for your in-field repairs.
Let's talk a bit about when to retire things. Mm-hmm. Like, let's like what point it's great to make things last, but what point do you keep repairing versus retiring?
I think it's situational on pieces of equipment. Some stuff you can repair it indefinitely, but at a certain point, like certain things like rock climbing ropes, for instance, like there's a manufacturer, like if you take a major fall, you should retire that rope. Same with whitewater kayaks. If you put a crack in a kayak, it's basically like climbing on a rope that's taken some big impacts on. But other things, like I have a rain jacket that I really like. It doesn't keep the rain off, but it helps break the wind. So I like to keep and hanging on to it. That way I'm not throwing it away. But it just depends on the piece of equipment that you're using.
Totally. For clothing, I think about it as like downgrading. Like you're going to, if you're doing like a big, long expedition, you're going to want to have your gear being top notch. But like your socks that have been, you know, on thousands of miles and are darned are probably fine for like an afternoon hike or whatnot. So I think it's just choosing the gear and what trip that you're going to take it on, but always continuing to repair it and extending the life of it. So, you know, Patrick's rain jacket might not go with him on a 10-day backpacking trip, but I'm sure around town or for an after-work run, it works fine.
So, Patrick, have you tried Nikwax or tried, how's that stuff work, like the re-coating, like Gore-Tex breathable materials? Does that work or not?
It does up to a certain point, but at a certain point, some materials just get so degraded that you can put those material or those chemicals on them, but it's still not going to keep the water out. This one, I know that the seams are leaking. I've even put seam repair on it, but it's just got some nostalgia for me, so I just keep hanging on to the jacket and don't want to get rid of it. But those materials do help keep it a little bit waterproof, so they can help. But at a certain point, you got to retire it or repurpose it for something else.
Yeah. Don't forget to harvest your materials before you get rid of it.
Yeah. I know at APU and other schools, students love old used gear. Like you might think that's absolutely useless, but there's always someone out there that really can't afford new gear that would appreciate old stuff. So passing on to people. We talked about some other common issues during our break. One of the things that came up were inflatable sleeping bags. So Jeremy, you brought that up. You want to talk about how to fix an inflatable sleeping bag? It's a bummer when your mattress deflates.
I actually think it's like one of the most depressing repairs situations you could have.
Wow.
Like, you know, you're not going to deal with it necessarily until morning, and you might just have a bad night of sleep as a result. But there are some very tangible ways where we can assess and fix challenges with inflatable sleeping pads, which, again, like a lot of the gear we're talking about, are shifting in a more lightweight, less durable direction. And I think one of the key problems folks have is identifying where the problem is. Where is the hole? Where are the many holes that you might need to fix? And one of the, like, if you have a body of water that you can stick your inflatable pad in, like this works at home in a bathtub, or if you're on a sea kayaking trip, you can use the ocean. But if you're in a place like the canyons where there is no like deep water where you can submerge your pad to look for bubbles, you can take soapy water and spread it over the sleeping pad. And you'll find that little bubbles will start to pop up wherever there are punctures in that sleeping pad. And once you've identified those, you should circle them with some sort of writing implement, being careful not to poke more holes in the pad. And then once that pad is completely dry, you can hop in with Aqua Seal, which is basically just going to be one of these waterproof glues that's going to work really well for tiny pinpricks. Or if you need to use some gear tape, again, thinking about a larger piece of tape than the hole itself so that you don't have air sneaking through. But that can sometimes be a multi-day process. You have found a few of the holes, you try it again after your pad slowly deflates over the night. But soap and water are going to be really helpful if you don't have some larger body of water where you can fully submerge the pad. And then, of course, it can always be the valve itself, which is a little bit harder to field repair, but something where you can buy spares to have with you if you know it's a common failure point with the piece of gear that you have.
Do you bring an extra little Insulite pad just in case? Or like a camp chair of some sort? Yeah.
I sure do. Yeah. Whether it's like a 3/4 length pad that is really thin, but I also like, and I can pair that with my backpack, which has at least some level of foam in the back panel. And so if I empty all that out, I have something akin to a sleeping pad. And then also looking for like nice, comfy places to sleep as opposed to granite, which is not going to promote a good night of sleep. And again, there may be resources if you're out with someone else that can help with this as well.
Other thing we talked about is stitching in the field. A little more, you mentioned different stitching. Any other follow up on that, Jamie? It just seems like a challenging thing for me to wrap my head around a little bit. Yeah.
So like when you prepare to go on an outdoor trip, you've like gained skills and acquired knowledge to be able to do these trips. So I think one piece of gaining knowledge and skills is learning the stitches or the like techniques needed to do repairs to make you be able to do them out in the field. So it's part of like your preparedness for that trip. Yeah. Maybe not something you would think about, but definitely if you have gear that fails, it's a matter of your safety and your enjoyment on your trip.
I agree with that too. When I first bought a Speedy Stitch, I had no idea how to use it. And then something broke in the field, but luckily one of the students on the trip knew how to use the Speedy Stitch. So I learned at that moment how to use it. But then I also went home and watched some YouTube videos on how to properly use a Speedy Stitch.
Yeah. Let's talk about zippers. First of all, advice on care of zippers, anybody?
I keep the zipper closed unless I'm putting something in there. I was just on the Grand Canyon this winter, and it was sand control, so we were just trying to keep the sand out of the zippers as much as possible. So for me, a closed zipper was a happy zipper, because if you get some sand and grit in there, sometimes they can get stuck. Also with pack rafting too, they have zipper tubes, which are great for camping. I carry a toothbrush with me now, just in case you get some little dirt and debris in there. You can use your personal toothbrush, but I like to take a spare toothbrush, so just something that I can keep in my life jacket to clean those zippers off them. And then check before you go. For instance, we had somebody rent a pack raft from us, and they took the pack raft. They didn't blow it up before they went out, and then they got flown into some place to do a trip, and they got there, went to go blow up the boat, and the boat would not hold air.
Always check it here. Any other thoughts about zipper repair, Jeremy?
I would echo a clean zipper is a happy zipper. And one of the pieces I think about too is like what gauge zipper, and like what size of zipper makes the most sense for where I am. So if we're going down the Grand Canyon with Patrick, we know we're in like a sandier environment where we're going to see more grit entering both the coil and through the slide. Mm-hmm. And so maybe a higher gauge zipper, maybe in that like 8 to 10 range, is going to allow for more of that sand to kind of move through and filter through on its own, versus again, these lightweight shelters, pant pockets, zippers on jackets, like those are getting down into that 3 and sometimes even smaller size zippers. And those are just going to fail way more easily under duress from the environment. And so what are the zipper, how big of a zipper do I want? In general, I opt for bigger zippers. When I think about like pre and post trip, lubing zippers is one of the things I just do habitually. And if you don't have zipper lube, chapstick can work well in a pinch, to like help clear out some of that gunk, get that zipper flowing well again. Our most common fix on repairs or things at Knowles is sleeping bag zippers and tent zippers. And that's because they spend more time in the dirt and in the sand. And it means we have to replace the slide most frequently, which is the part you're pulling up and down on in order to seal the coil. It's very rarely the coil itself that is failing. And so diagnosing the problem, having extra slides for whatever zippers you know you're bringing into the field, and making sure you trust the zippers that you do have.
Yeah, great points. Yeah. I think also you can add cleaning it with like compressed air once you're home to like get any grit out of that zipper slide or zipper pull. But sometimes zippers just fail and you need to replace them, which again is like a hard thing to do. So this is a good point where you can like contact the original manufacturing of it, and some companies will replace things and like do the repair for you, but sometimes they won't. And a good follow-up question after you've asked if they have a warranty or a repair system is to ask for the piece that failed. So like if you have, you know, your insulated pants that have a two-way separating zipper on, you know, that's a specific zipper you're not going to be able to find anywhere. So ask them for sending that replacement piece, and then hopefully you can get that repaired either with yourself on a sewing machine or at a local tailor, but just getting the item. And this extends not just for zippers, but for any other like trims on your clothing. Addition to that, it gives the company like information and like resources of like what is failing and why it's failing and when, so that then when they go into their design process, they have that knowledge base and can hopefully improve their gear as well.
And I think there's also a few places in Anchorage, at least here, that will fix your zipper or replace it. I know Alaska Tent and Tarp works on them. There's a couple other businesses that repair zippers and replace them, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Excellent. We're about to wrap up here. I guess I want to finish up a bit with a question for each one of you. What's your best advice for gear care?
For gear care, if you need to fix something, I really like looking at YouTube. YouTube is a great resource to get on there, and if you're trying to figure out how to fix something, it'll have a lot of the answers for you. And then just hanging out with your more experienced friends, like Paul Tordock, he's a great resource. So if you go on a trip, I really like it when I see somebody has a nice repair kit and it's well organized and they have stuff to help fix it. But preventative care, like we've talked about too, but YouTube is a great resource.
You guys, really old guys like me, Patrick, you learn a lot about gear repair because all our stuff needs to be repaired. Jamie?
I think the biggest thing you can do is to practice your skills and just be committed to like a lifestyle of repairing, not just in with your gear, but in your regular clothes as well. So practicing skills, practicing it on your clothes that maybe don't matter as much and need to function as well, doing it with friends, sharing skills. So practice.
Sounds like
learning.
A party.
Yeah, totally.
Jeremy?
Pay attention. Like keep track of what gear of yours is continually performing well and what gear, where you're seeing failure points. That's going to inform what goes in your repair kit. That's going to inform what skills you need to have, but it also might inform your next decision about what gear you want to buy. For example, you can spend a ton of money on a rain jacket and a ton of money on rain pants. But one of them you're going to be like consistently sitting on all of the time. And so like rain pants are more likely to fail in the seat than and so is that a place where you want to spend money, or do you want to spend more money on that rain jacket that you can care for and be and just like use in a variety of different ways? So pay attention to what's failing and how you can take care of it, but also think about that as you're making decisions as a consumer and advocating for what you want to see the outdoor industry creating.
Oh, nice. Advocation, yeah, for better here. Well, thank you all for joining me. This has been Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Tordock. I've had Jeremy Cronin with the National Outdoor Leadership School, Jamie Herrera, who teaches classes about career design and reuse at the museum, and Patrick Higgins, who directs the Outdoor Studies Program at APU. Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks for having us.
Paul.
Right now, we have some APU students in the studio with me to talk about the APU Career Swap on April 5th. Jerry, go ahead and tell us a bit about it. Where's it at? When is it? And how do people get involved?
Hi, Paul. So our gear swap is April 5th at 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. What we're doing is you're bringing in gear you don't want anymore. You have just leftover stuff that you haven't overused, specifically gear that isn't motorized, stuff like backpacks, skiing, biking equipment, boating equipment, rafting, non-motorized gear such as jackets and clothing, outdoor specific clothing is also welcome.
Yep.
You're welcome to drop this off at around April 4th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. and April 5th from 8 to 9 a.m. at the Mosley Sports Center here at APU campus. Any gear that is not picked up by 2 p.m. on Saturday, April 5th, will be donated.
So great. So it's an opportunity to maybe sell your gear.
Yes.
And APU takes a commission, right?
Yes, 15%.
15%. All right. And then that money is doing what? It's supporting
the outdoor APU program, supporting multiple students, like getting us gear to go on our trips and our classes.
All right. That broke college students always need some help. So
always.
That's fantastic. Michael, tell us a little bit more. What do you have about the gear swap you want to share with us?
So if you want to get registered for the gear swap, you can go to the APU gear swap website where you can go on and register whatever gear you want to bring in. And you can bring in that gear on April 4th, anytime between 4:30 and 7 p.m., or on the day of April 5th from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m.
Excellent. I know it's very popular. I've been involved in this. If I'm a seller, I'm going to show up on Friday and drop the gear off. What process do I have to get registered? You said you went to the website and registered. Is there something else I need to do?
After you find the link that's on our website, you have to print off your labels and barcodes. This will help us like keep track of the items and to mark your prices. Right. We like to price to sale. So before you putting on your barcodes, we would like you to come up with a sale price. So for example, if you're selling a boat, I would suggest taking that boat's price and thinking of how much you've used it and how much you should take off.
So if it's an old boat, I take off more. If it's a new boat, I take off less. I got a boat to sell. I'm selling a kayak, pretty nice kayak actually. So I'll take that advice into account. I think a lot of people show up for this, right?
Yes.
Have you guys been there before?
I have not.
Have not?
No.
Yeah. It's a lot of people. Like I think there's a line out the door of people wanting to buy stuff at 10 a.m. What else is important about this clear swap?
It gives a lot to the college. It's a good opportunity to meet other people in the community who might share your outdoor activities. We'll also have the papaya tree food truck there, so you'll have an opportunity to try some community food. And it's not just for supporting the college, but does a good to build the community out and help you network to new people.
Well, thank you very much, guys. This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. We've been talking about the APU Clear Swap, which is on April 5th at the Mosley Sports Center. And we will have a link on the Outdoor Explorer website with a link to the Clear Swap and registration.
Thanks to my guest, Jeremy Cronin with the National Outdoor Leadership School, Jamie Hirano with the Anchorage Museum, Patrick Higgins with Alaska Pacific University's Outdoor Studies Program, and his students, Jerry and Michael. Also, thanks to our producer, Tobin Shelby, with additional help from Ammon Swenson. I'm your host, Paul Torda, and from all the hosts of Outdoor Sport, take care of yourself and your gear, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
This program was brought to you by Jim and Shirley Brown's Apartments, located in Sand Point above Trident Seafoods and the Boat Harbor. Featuring two-bedroom apartments on a month-to-month basis. For more information, call Jim Brown at 386-6050.
KSDP 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
It's time now for your weather, tide predictions, and sunrise and sunset. Starting with your coastal water forecast, courtesy of the National Weather Service of Anchorage, Alaska. From Sitkanap to Castle Cape, gale warning tonight.